Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books, including We Need to Talk About Putin and The Weaponization of Everything, which is recently out. Thank you very much for joining me today, Mark.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
All right, great to have you. And I should mention Mark has very generously agreed to be my guest on this podcast once every month or so. So listeners now have the opportunity to hear his insights on a regular basis. And his appearance today comes at a potentially crucial juncture in the crisis over Russia's military buildup near Ukraine's borders and its sweeping demands for restrictions on NATO membership and deployments. Of course, there have been several junctures that have appeared crucial since this crisis began late last year. But just to try to recap briefly, on Friday, the leaders of the Russia-backed separatists who control parts of Ukraine's Donetsk and Luhansk regions abruptly issued announcements of mass evacuations to Russia, claiming without evidence that the Ukrainian government was planning an offensive in the coming days. Now, these announcements they then ordered call-ups of men of military age in both of those regions. These announcements of the evacuations were almost certainly recorded 2 days in advance, according to metadata on the statements. They followed a development last week in which the Russian Parliament's lower house, in which the Kremlin-controlled United Russia Party holds more than a two-thirds majority, appealed to President Vladimir Putin to recognize the territory claimed by the Russia-backed separatists in Donetsk and Luhansk as independent countries. Now, Putin took no action on this and suggested he would not recognize them, at least not right away, in order to make a further push for implementation of the Minsk Accords, which are agreements aimed to resolve the conflict in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine, and resolve it in the way that Russia interprets these Minsk Accords. Now, over the weekend, Belarus, north of Ukraine, announced that joint exercises that have brought many Russian troops to that country would continue past their scheduled end date, which was yesterday. This added to fears of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. But on the other hand, yesterday, there emerged a tentative, at least, agreement for U.S. President Joe Biden and Putin to meet at some point, probably towards the end of next week or later. But it's conditioned on the idea. Sorry, the U.S. says this meeting could go ahead if Russia does not invade Ukraine in the meantime. And from what the U.S. Has been saying, that's a big if, because U.S. officials have been saying for some time that there could be a Russian invasion any day now. Mark, I just there's sort of a lot going on here, and it's I'll just ask you this: what's going on? It's obviously hard to predict, but it does look like we're seeing, does it look like we are seeing final preparations for a Russian invasion? Or maybe a fresh push by Moscow to resolve the Donbass conflict in its favor, or maybe both or neither?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. Does it look like an imminent invasion and on a massive scale? Yes. Do we know if that means that that's actually what they're planning on doing, or that they're still hoping to be able to intimidate Kyiv and the West into making the kind of concessions that they want? That's still possible. We're being told that, you know, battle plans have been distributed and everyone's ready. Mm-hmm. But even so, you know, right up to the 11th hour and the 59th minute, Putin can change his mind. And that's not unusual. You know, there are all kind of cases in the past where massive forces have been mustered and then a deal was struck. So it's really very difficult to know. But the interesting thing is the fact that the Russians are still, you know, clearly willing, indeed eager to talk, suggests that this is not just simply a pure farce just while they sort of build up their forces, because essentially they've got their forces there. And if there is some kind of massive attack, well, the fact that they were willing to have a sit down between Sergei Lavrov and Liz Truss, the British Foreign Secretary, that's not really going to count in their favor on the kind of grand scale of things. It's actually going to be the sites of whatever it is, Kyiv burning or thousands of refugees on the road, that will sort of set how this war is interpreted. So, I mean, I think, and again, maybe here I'm being ludicrously optimistic, that actual military operation is still plan B. But on the other hand, we may well be getting closer than ever to the shift down from plan A to plan B. But I think in that context, we do need to think about, shall we say, some of these sub-apocalyptic options, which clearly were sort of foreshadowed by the whole business of these Duma bills requesting that Putin recognize the People's Republics, quote unquote.
Right.
In that, you know, it does offer a way that, if Putin wants to do something dramatic but doesn't actually want to trigger the kind of, total sanctions and indeed long and bloody and open-ended conflict, which a full-scale invasion would mean, then the option of recognizing these pseudo-states and then quickly reaching some kind of agreement that allows Russian peacekeepers to be deployed, it would still obviously trigger some kind of sanctions,
right,
but not as much. It would signal pretty much an end to the Minsk process, but really we have to ask actually whether or not the Minsk process is as dead can be anyway. And it would in a way sort of shift the nature of the relationship, but also the conflict between Moscow and Kyiv. And in many ways would be a kind of defeat for Russian policy. Mm-hmm. But again, it would be a way of, as it were, turning the defeat from being a long-term stalemate into something that looks a little bit more glorious, even if, in fact, it's no better for Moscow.
That's very interesting. I mean, I guess one thing that might be on the Kremlin's mind is, if they do recognize these separatist-held parts of Donetsk and Luhansk as countries and then go in there, as you say, it would set up a kind of a different situation. And maybe, it seems possible that Putin would sort of take that, as you say, kind of defeat, but cast it as a victory and then think, well, I'll do something more later. But of course, I really have no idea. I mean, what strikes me, two things that strike me, about what you said. One is that it definitely, there's been, even though Lavrov and other Russian officials have said, for weeks that, NATO, the U.S. likes to drag things out and that there's a limit to the, time for diplomacy. It seems to me that it's, that Russia's been clearly kind of, every time there's a critical juncture like this, going with the idea that, okay, we're still ready for more diplomacy. Certainly the U.S. Is as well. So how long can you go without that changing? And the other thing is, I think in the last few weeks and particularly days, Russia's obviously been putting a lot of emphasis on the idea of, well, Kyiv just has to implement the Minsk agreements and in the way that Russia interprets them. But as I think you suggest, sort of the chances of this happening, of Kyiv implementing them in the way that Russia sees them, which is a way that would give Moscow big leverage over Ukraine, it's not that likely. So the question is, what's next? Is it a big invasion? Is it recognition? More diplomacy? It seems up in the air. I guess I'd just ask, follow up with the question. I mean, how much do you think the idea or the prospect of a summit, an actual summit between Biden and Putin, might change, I guess, the calculus in the Kremlin?
I mean, if a summit is going to happen, then I think they'll presumably hold their fire until that happens, just to wait and see if there's anything substantive that comes. I can't see them being in a position in which they feel they have to move beforehand, and they can't wait an extra week, 2 weeks, whatever it'll take. So, I mean, in part, this is, of course, actually, let's be honest, this is the West trying to draw things out long enough that the Russians decide that actually it's not worth it, and they de-escalate. The same way as this very sort of innovative information campaign that we're seeing, constantly saying, oh, we think they're going to attack this day, they're going to do a false flag or whatever.
Right.
That is, as much as anything else, intended to try and pre-bunk various sort of Russian gambits and get them to think, oh, no, let's give it a moment. I mean, it's interesting that Zhirinovsky got in on the act. He's predicting tomorrow, the 22nd of February, for reasons symbolic,
right.
22nd of the 2nd of 2022. So, you know, everyone's getting into their sort of picking of dates. And I think this is the point, that actually the Russians, on the one hand, they're clearly aware of not wanting to leave this going on, because Putin keeps mentioning it. But on the other hand, so long as there is a prospect that they'll get something that they regard as an acceptable deal, whatever that may be, then you know they have no reason not to. I mean, they can keep this force in the field for some time to come, despite the fact that it's uncomfortable for a lot of soldiers and it costs a fair amount of money. This is the thing about authoritarian regimes. When they want to do something, they basically can do it. So this may well be open-ended. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it's worth mentioning that in terms of options, I mean, at the moment, we think of it very much as this kind of binary of, you know, full-scale invasion or not. I mean, if one talks, you know, just again, go back briefly to the recognition sort of option. Mm-hmm. I mean, that can be done in a low-intensity and high-intensity way. A low-intensity way is just simply use the way, okay, you basically fix the current borders and you have them protected by Russian soldiers, which obviously will have a certain impact. A high-intensity way is you say, well, because the evil Ukrainians are constantly attacking us, I mean, that may not actually be, you know, true in technical terms, but in propaganda terms, who cares?
Right.
I mean, it's clear that the Russians are definitely ramping up the propaganda machine at the moment. But anyway, because of the evil Ukrainians and the threat of genocide, etc., we need to have a security cordon, we need to have more defensible borders, and therefore it could be associated with a push back to sort of fix the borders in slightly different locations, and also to use that as an opportunity for a demonstrative exercise in Russian military firepower, just to make the point that exactly, you know, if Ukraine messes with Russia, things can get very bloody. So this would be a kind of combination of signaling as well as they're actually trying to change the facts on the ground. They do have all kind of options. And even if this is stood down now, if there is not some kind of resolution, then who's to say it's not going to, you know, re-happen in a month, 6 months, a year's time? So I think that one of the key issues will be, yes, of course, there is a real desire on the part of not just Kyiv, but also the West, to deal with this current crisis. But unless it's just simply yet another can being kicked down the road, one also has to think about a resolution. And to be perfectly honest, a resolution is not just simply about threatening sanctions and hoping that that's enough, because clearly it's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there may well be mileage in, well, it won't be Minsk 3 because the Ukrainians have made it clear that they won't go back to Minsk. But, you know, Erdogan has offered, so maybe it will be Ankara 1.
Right.
But, you know, some new peace process. Because when it comes down to it, one way or the other, if this conflict is to be resolved, then either Ukraine has to actually say the Donbass region is dead to us. It is no longer part of Ukraine. In other words, they need to pull the trigger, or else then the region will have to be in some ways reintegrated. And that almost certainly will mean some kind of special status. If one looks at how conflict zones get reintegrated into polities, I mean, it is a painful process. It involves talking to deeply unpleasant people and making certain compromises that you'd rather not, and resting in the fact that you hope that in a generation or two generation or three generations' time, all the various conflicts will have been ironed out, and that your system is strong enough to actually be able to cope with that. I mean, again, this is the thing. There is a difference between dealing with this crisis and resolving the problem. And ultimately, if we don't have some moves towards resolving the problem, we're going to be back here.
back in around the NATO summit later this year. And I mean,
well, I mean, just simply the fact that Russia could you know, basically, Russia can always escalate this way.
Right.
It's a question of actually, you know, what is going to make Russia feel both less willing to and also less interested in.
Right. All right. So that's I think many agree that this crisis is probably here to stay for quite some time. Now, I'd just like to move on. You know, one thing that the Russian threats to Ukraine and its demands of the West have done is taken some attention away from Russia itself and what's happening inside Russia. So the second question I want to ask is about Alexei Navalny, who's now on trial in prison and could be sentenced to over 10 more years in prison in the latest in a series of cases he dismisses as politically motivated. Now, this trial is one of a number of domestic developments that I'd say are getting less attention than they otherwise might due to the situation surrounding Ukraine. Mark, for many years, the Kremlin seemed to be wary of putting Navalny behind bars for an extended period of time. He was often jailed, you know, for several days, but he was not imprisoned for years, presumably because the Kremlin feared a backlash and protest. Now, that changed after his return to Russia in January 2021, and he's now in prison for 2.5 years, which works out, I believe, to the middle of 2023. But with this new trial, he could be in prison for more than a decade more, potentially past the next two presidential elections due in 2024 and 2030. And we know that Putin has the right now to run in those elections. Now, has something fundamental changed in Putin's thinking and the Kremlin's thinking about the challenge that Navalny poses?
I don't think so. I think at the time, I mean, I wasn't by any means the only person who was suggesting that actually whatever the initial sentence that was placed on Navalny, there's no way this system was going to let him come out before the 2024 presidential elections. Mm-hmm. And I think this is just simply the way they decided to handle it. Rather than slapping some, you know, particularly extensive, well, we'll see, even more extensive sentence on him the first time round, this is an exercise in, and I will call it salami slicing, but in this case it's pretty much half a salami, of putting him in prison, waiting a while, seeing what the situation looks like, and then particularly at a point when everyone is distracted, and you know, you're perfectly right, at the moment, one would be hard-pressed to believe that anything was happening in Russia that wasn't related to the current Russia-Ukraine crisis. You know, at a time when everyone is distracted, then basically they'll as it were, bring out the next stage in their campaign against him. And it's not, I think, that the thinking about the challenge he poses has particularly changed, though they presumably are calculating the fact that they have dismantled his entire sort of apparatus across the country. It's more that from their point of view, I think they definitely have moved into an era of precautionary repression in the sense of it's not that they necessarily feel that they have a real specific need to keep Navalny behind bars. It's more that they have no reason to let him out because he might be a problem and therefore play it safe, keep him behind bars. And it's that kind of approach, I think, that is behind, you know, so much of the repressions we've seen. They decided to sweep the board clean from their point of view well before the 2024 presidential elections. They don't want to be arresting people. They don't want to be dealing with protests right on the eve of the elections. So anyway, they're getting all the bad stuff done quickly. So then the hope, and again, it may well be this is be totally derailed if things do go into an escalatory mode in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. But from the point of view of the people who you might say have been tasked with the political campaign, so that's Vino and Kirienko in the presidential administration, that's Mishustin at the head of the government, I think the plan was precisely to then have a couple of years of high-profile moves towards addressing people's day-to-day concerns with, you know, infrastructure developments and such like, to try and kind of reconcile a clearly rather disgruntled population. And just from their point of view, the last thing they want is someone like Navalny out there stirring things up. So just you know, lose the key. leave him behind bars until you really don't think that he can be of any more danger.
I wonder whether those guys, Vino, Kirienko, Shustin, are kind of hoping there is no big escalation in Ukraine ahead of the elections. But we'll see.
I should mention on that, sorry, just to cut in, but absolutely. Actually, I mean, we are seeing a few little signs of very, very cautious discontent. I mean, we've already seen it from within the security apparatus, particularly sort of the middle rank and retired figures. There was the now notorious Ivashov letter from the sort of chair of the Union of Russian Officers. Mm-hmm. But generally, there is also a sense that there is dissatisfaction with the way things are going, not because they necessarily have moral or ethical problems with what's happening in Ukraine, but because inevitably, if there is a war, that will mean sanctions, that will mean people coming home in body bags, and that will make the job of the political technologists mm-hmm. and the economic managers that much more difficult. But of course, they're still going to be expected to produce the results come 2024. So, I mean, I think that, you know, there is this really clear sense that from their point of view, the cadre of Siloviki, the cadre of security types that seem to be sort of really mustered around Putin and really at the moment seem to be shaping policy, mm-hmm. their interests are different from those of the civilian technocrats. And the civilian technocrats are being reminded of just how insignificant they are at the court of Tsar Putin.
All right. Well, that's extremely interesting, Mark. We're running out of time, and we'll have to wrap it up. Thank you very much for joining me, and I hope to talk to you again in the next month or so.
Always a pleasure.
All right. So I'll be back next Monday, and please keep an eye out on Friday for my Week in Russia newsletter. Thanks for listening.